I want to talk a little bit about safek pikuach nefesh, what happens when you're not sure whether it's life-threatening. That will actually end up being a relatively straightforward topic, I hope. And then sakanas eiver, this issue of danger to a part of the body, what exactly that means. And we've talked about that a little bit already, but we're going to get more specific on it and give a couple of applications for it. In the event that we get through those with, 10, 15 minutes to spare, then we'll have a quiz. If not, it ends up being pushed to the next class. I really don't want to do that to you because that means that you've got like 2 weeks and you have to remember everything we talked about. And even though it is open notes, I sort of feel like that's not nice. So I want to see if we can get to it today. And we'll see. We'll see what happens. Everyone clear? Good. Okay, and everyone has the notes. The source sheet. Okay. Then let's get started. So, safek pikuach nefesh. We've already said that if you're not sure whether somebody needs something done, some intervention to save their lives, we intervene, right? We talked about that. We said that you're not even supposed to ask, you just do, as long as you think that they might be in danger. So the source for that is the Mishnah in the first source on the sheet. Mishnah in the last parak in Yuma. Yoma and Yuma, just for reference, are the same thing. It's the title of the Masechta in Shas that is about Yom Kippur. So the Mishnah there in the 8th parak is talking about eating on Yom Kippur, and we bring Shabbos into the discussion as well. So it says, Hachoshesh bigrono matilin lo sam besoch piv b'Shabbos v'bnei shehu safek nefashos v'chol safek nefashos doch es ha-Shabbos. So even though we've talked about not using medication on Shabbos for a mild illness or mild pain on Shabbos, nonetheless, if somebody has what sounds like a sore throat, we will give them this medication on Shabbos because it's safek nefashos. Now, that doesn't mean that a sore throat is automatically safek nefashos. But some kind of a condition that they were worried about, and I don't know how to identify the disease we're talking about, but some kind of condition where somebody had a sore throat was considered to be safek nefashos, and we say that overrides Shabbos. So what qualifies as a safek? Safek nefashos means, thank you for the question, doubt about a life and death matter. I'd say, you know why? Because until now I've been calling it safek pikuach nefesh. Right? We know pikuach nefesh is looking after life, saving life. Safek pikuach nefesh is uncertainty about that. So the same thing, safek nefashos means doubt about life, about survival. Is that clear? Okay. So the big question, which I pointed out when we talked about pikuach nefesh already, couple of weeks ago, is safek, doubt, is a big place. What does that mean, doubt about? Before Yom Kippur, when people were reaching out to me from my community asking about whether they needed to fast and what they should be eating and that sort of thing. So there were all sorts of safek cases. There were cases of people with diabetes where that raises serious questions about whether one can fast because of fluctuations in blood sugar. And, those cases are absolutely each one an independent question that has to be dealt with both medical professionals as well as a rabbi. There were people who were recovering from surgeries and had been told you have to make sure to eat in order to be able to recover from the surgery. But the doubts are extremely uncertain in terms of really knowing how much danger am I in if I don't eat. I'll give you one example. There was somebody who had a surgery for which the surgeon had said you must have for the next 4 weeks you have to have a full nutritious diet. You have to you have to have proteins and you have to have vegetables and so on and so on and so on. But the doctor was not Jewish, knew nothing about Yom Kippur, and was not accessible for me to ask them. I tried, reaching them to ask them, just, what exactly was about. I ended up talking to another surgeon who explained to me the problem. The protocol is 4 weeks of proper nutrition after this kind of surgery, and no studies have been done in which somebody decides to fast during that period for, a 24-hour period during the 4 weeks, because who would do a study like that? So it's not that we know if you fast for a day during the 4 weeks, now the recovery from the surgery is going to be corrupted and terrible things will happen and there'll be an infection and whatever else. We actually don't know. So what do you do? How do you deal with that kind of a circumstance when you just don't have data? So that's where suffix becomes difficult. What do you do when you have doubt? Do you understand? Am I rambling or I'm being clear? Okay. So Rosh Lomo Zalman Auerbach gives a standard based on a piece from Rabbi Akiva Eiger, but I'm bringing you Rosh Lomo Zalman on it. Rosh Lomo Zalman Auerbach, one of the greatest halachic authorities of the end of the 20th century in Eretz Yisrael, and in particular, a voice on medical halacha issues, modern technology issues. So he says what you see in source number two, reading my English translation. Regarding the essential matter of what is called safek pikuach nefesh and what is not, right? What is called possible life-saving? What isn't? And where is the boundary? I have also been in great doubt about this. He says, I don't know either. I don't have certainty either. But logically, in my humble opinion, in any case where most people would flee from this circumstance, like one who flees from danger, if people would avoid this kind of a situation in the way that people avoid dangerous situations, they treat it as though it's, a life and death issue, that's considered safek pikuach nefesh. And we apply in such a case the rule of you shall live by them and not to die by them. But if most people would not be scared of this, it's not called danger. So in other words, you may have somebody who says, I'm going to pick a random illness, and that's always dangerous to do, but nonetheless, pick a random illness. Let's say, somebody has strep throat. Or you know what? I'll get practical, a practical case. Another of the questions I received before Yom Kippur, somebody tested positive for COVID. And you're talking about somebody who's probably, I would ballpark, in their 50s, and they have some asthma, so separate from the COVID. They have a little bit of an underlying respiratory condition. Do they need to eat? Do they need to drink? So most people at this point, unless they have pre-existing conditions, tend to treat COVID like, any other illness. They avoid infecting other people and they look after themselves and, they get through it in a couple of days and it's over. That tends to be the way it's looked at now, as opposed to, what it was, 2 or 3 years ago. So if you're talking about somebody who, for most people in that situation, with that set of factors, they would say, I'm not in a life or death, situation, then we don't treat it as a life and death situation. On the other hand, if indeed people treat that as life and death and say you have to hydrate, you have to eat, you have to, get all sorts of care in order to survive this, then that's the way that we look at it. That's what Rosh Lomo Zalman is saying. Is that clear? Okay. So the problem is that there's one word here which can be used in two different ways. When we talk about safek pikuach nefesh or safek nefashos, the word safek can be applied in two different directions, and this is really important. So I want to make sure to spell it out. The normal case for which we use safek nefashos or safek pikuach nefesh, and the way that we've been using it until now, is the person is ill, And I don't know how much danger they're in, right? It's doubt about the level of danger. That's what it's meant so far, right? But what else, when I'm treating a patient, what else might I be doubtful about? I might be doubtful about how sick they are, but I also might be doubtful about another aspect of this. Yeah, Ella.
Maybe like if your treatment will like even help.
Exactly. Doubt about the treatment. It's all well and good to say this person is dangerously ill, therefore I have to treat them on Shabbos. But let's say the treatment, which would require violating Shabbos, is one that I don't know if it's actually going to be effective. That's another type of doubt. Now, we never have guarantees with treatments, right? Treatments can be, tested and used for years and years and years, and yet they, don't work for a particular individual. So there's a difference between, I think that it'll work, but, this person might be unique, or something that is entirely new. Something that is entirely untested. That's a different story. So that's where we distinguish. When we're talking about doubt that the person's life is in danger, so that's like what we saw in source number one. And we say, treat it as though you know they are in danger. This is like the case that we talked about where the person is traveling in the wilderness and they're afraid to stay alone over Shabbos when their caravan is going to abandon them. Right? That's where we say, break Shabbos, that's what you do. So take a look at source number three, the Shulchan Aruch, where it says, if one doctor says the treatment is necessary, and one doctor says it's not necessary, we violate Shabbos, because we don't know. So that's what we'll do, is we'll override Shabbos for it. And there's a view that we do not need an expert, for all people are considered somewhat expert. And when in doubt, we rule leniently. Right? There is a view that says that even if the person themselves says, I'm sick, that's already sufficient. So from the perspective of doubt that this person is that sick, the rule is going to be override Shabbos for them. Clear? As long as you go back to Shlomo Zalman's standard, as long as it's a thing that people, generally speaking, consider to be dangerous. What about doubt that the treatment is going to work? So here we get more skeptical. We require some level of confidence. If you take a look at source number four, this is the same Mishnah that was in source number one, just a different part of the same Mishnah. A person is bitten by a rabid dog. So the Mishnah says you don't feed that person from the liver of that dog. Ramasya ben Charash says, no, you actually can. I've heard it argued that this is some kind of early anticipation of vaccination, because you're using something that has the germs, maybe. Maybe. But at some point it was thought that treatment for rabies, if somebody was bitten by a rabid dog, involved taking a piece of the liver from that dog and having the person eat it. Clearly, the liver is not kosher, right? This is not a Shabbos issue. This is a kashrus issue. But the Mishnah says we're not giving this person the liver from that dog. Rashi explains why. If you take a look at source number five, right, where it says we don't. Sorry, the word don't should appear there. We don't feed him of its liver. That's his quote from the Mishnah. Rashi says, even though doctors do this, in the time of the Mishnah, there were doctors who prescribed this. It is not a complete medicine such that we would permit non-kosher meat for it. We don't really consider this to be medicine. It doesn't rise to that level. So, whereas I'm not sure the person is that sick, we err on the side of caution and say treat them. If I'm not sure that this is actually medical, then I don't give the treatment. Now, How do you know whether something is a valid medication or not? What are you going to do? So the so what Rashi requires, and not only Rashi, but this is something that you see in many halachic works, is some kind of expert certification. Either it has to be the medicine that everybody uses, or it has to be that experts have said this works. If you take a look at source number 6, Rabbi Avram Gambiner, the Magen Avram, commenting on the Shulchan Aruch, he says, we require a known medicine or a medicine recommended by an expert. It can't just be, I decided that this is what I need, right? You could otherwise imagine a situation in which somebody is, you know, not feeling well and really to the point of being dangerously ill, and they decide the medication that they need is, you know, is penicillin. But what's wrong with them is, like, you know, I don't know, cancer. So they decided that this is their medication. We're not now going to throw medications at them that make no sense. Because they, you know, because somebody somewhere said that this might be good for them. We don't do that. Now, this is a bigger discussion about how we test medications, how we know that they work, right? You didn't have double-blind trials, you know, controls and all of that in the days of the Gemara. On the other hand, they did have testing mechanisms. The Gemara talks about testing something three times in a row, and does it work three times in a row with three different people? Like, there was a system for examining the effectiveness of a medical treatment. And that's what, you know, that's the building block for finding out, figuring out what is considered appropriate. I brought you source number 7. I want to be careful to preface it by saying that the source number 7 talks about what is popularly termed alternative medicine. It may include homeopathic medications as an example. That's a big topic, you know, the issue of alternative medicine. If you go to yutara.org, I've given classes about it. This is just one source, so don't take it as definitive of the entire topic. But take a look at number 7, where Rabbi Usher Weiss, a major halachic authority in Israel today, weighs in on alternative medicine to discuss this question of what's considered to be accepted as medication. He says, one may not violate Shabbos and transgress other than for a tested cure established by intellect and experience. You have to understand why it would work. You have to have experience that it does work. Frankly, according to many authorities, it could be either of those. But he says, in my humble opinion, alternative medicine is not in this category. Many are those who err and mislead with this medicine, and the masses place their hope in insubstantial things which are vapor and re'ut ruach, which doesn't have a good translation into English, but it doesn't matter for our purposes. And although there certainly are correct and beneficial principles in alternative medicine, as well as many practitioners who are expert and people of integrity, but it is hard to know whether one is coming or going, and light and dark serve in a jumble. He says some of the alternative medicines are good, but it's hard to know which ones. It's hard to know what's proper and what's not. Certainly this medicine is not tested by intellect and experience like traditional medicine, so therefore he's not a fan. That's a, you know, and again, it's a bigger topic. I'm not saying that this is the last word on it. I'm bringing it as an example of where you have doubt that a medicine works, as opposed to where you have doubt that the person is actually in danger. Clear? Okay. So that wraps the topic of Safek Pikuach Nefesh. But in case I didn't make it clear, I'm going to say make it clear now. One of the quiz questions will be about these two different kinds of doubt. I think I pretty much telegraphed that already, but that's why I want to make sure that I'm expressing it clearly. That's the main point to understand here. Okay. Questions on that, or should we go on to Sakanas Aver? Yeah, Abby.
So he said that he's not like a fan of alternative medicine treatment.
Right.
But we were saying before that, let's say like
it was a known practice to drink Kiloran, like we were saying.
Yeah.
That be considered medicine that was like proven or an alternative?
So, a medicine that is in popular use and seen to be effective will qualify as mainstream medicine. That was why I hedged when he said established by intellect and experience. That makes it sound like you need to know how it works as well as see that it works. But I think where it's seen to work, that's generally accepted. Other questions? Okay. So let's talk about Sakanas Eber. So, we brought up Sakanas Eber originally when we went through the basic list of categories. And Sakanas Eber, we said then, is danger to a body part. That was the way that we defined it. We said the type of danger is danger that that body part will no longer function the way that it's supposed to function, right? This rings a bell? Okay. In the event that danger to a body part could lead to danger to life, then it's in the category of safek pikuach nefesh, or safek nefashos, right? Then you're back where we were before. We're talking about now where we know it's not going to be a threat to life. The only question is, this body part is no longer going to function the way that it is supposed to function. And so we debate how to take care of it on Shabbos. Now, you could make the argument that we should put it in the category of chola she'ein bo sakana, right? A person who is ill, but their life is not in danger. But we break it out as its own topic, without the Shulchan Aruch ever explaining why, without the Gemara explaining why. Why is this its own topic? Why isn't it just part of Chola She'ein Bo Sakana? Any thoughts on why this should be any different? Why not just, yeah, Naomi.
Well, maybe even though it's not like it's not gonna endanger your life, but it is on a higher level, like losing a body part is not some serious thing. It's not so like something not to be serious about. So maybe it does have some higher aspects and you have to delve into more specifics for that.
Right. So I think that's one possibility. If I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, Naomi is saying that the loss of a body part is a bigger deal than, potentially a bigger deal than general illness. Right? Is that what you're saying? If you are, that's good. If you're not, it's also good. But
Yeah.
okay. So that's one approach. That's the approach of Rabbi Rafal Evers in his work, Veshav VaRafa. If you look at source number 10, I'm going to come back to 8 and 9, but take a look at source number 10, where he says, it appears, in my humble opinion, he's a contemporary rabbi, as you see, living in Holland. It appears, in my humble opinion, that the meaning is that regarding a patient who is not dangerously ill, right, ill but not life in danger, the pain is temporary, transient, it goes away over time, and the cure is to save him from whatever he's suffering from right now. They did not permit violating rabbinic prohibitions, right? There's a whole thing, shinui, not shinui, we'll talk about that, not today. But this is not so for sakanat aver, danger to a body part, where the deficiency is permanent, parentheses at least in an adult, which I'm not going into right now, and he will remain blemished forever without the cure. And so they permitted a Jew to violate a rabbinic prohibition to save him from this. So one reason why we're more lenient when we're dealing with danger to a body part is because we don't want someone to suffer a permanent loss of a body part. The other argument that I've seen brought is that even though I just said to you before, if there's danger to the body as a whole, that's called safek pikuach nefesh, sometimes you don't see that it's going to be dangerous for the whole body, but that's where it goes. Once we talk about losing a body part, that can have repercussions. Rav David Zvi Hoffman made this point. I didn't give you the years for him there. I'm not sure why, but he was, if I remember correctly, 19th century Germany. maybe into the early 20th, not 100% sure. But if you take a look at source number 8, he points you to the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. Gemara in Avodah Zarah says, if a person's eye revolts, and it's not clear in the text what exactly a revolting eye means, they go on to discuss, does it mean that it's got pus coming out of it? Like, what exactly is wrong? But you're allowed to treat it with kachol on Shabbos. Kachol is essentially, you know, a form of eyeshadow, right? Kachol is blue. I once learned that it's an alcohol based eye treatment, and that the eyeshadow, the blue eyeshadow that they had, was alcohol based. And alcohol, you know, is an Arabic word, al kuchla, from which we get kachol. I don't know if any of that made any sense. I said that a little bit quickly, but don't worry about it. The point is that if the eye is having this condition, you're allowed to treat it on Shabbos. Why? The key is the next part of the Gemara. Because the nerves of the eye are linked to the fat around the heart. Somehow, it is understood that there is danger involving the heart as a result of a condition around the eye. Now, that's actually something that has medical explanations for it. There's something, I believe it's called the oculocardiac reflex. I'm not going into the whole thing right now. But there's a thing about actually massaging around the eye to influence the pacing of the heart, believe it or not. There's you can look up oculocardiac reflex if you want. Don't do it right now, though, please. And you'll see it there. The point is, though, the eye is connected to the heart in the from the Gemara's perspective. And Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman says, if you look in source number 9, that kind of a connection is what's involved with Safek Pikuach Nefesh, when we're worried about, about Sakanas Eivir, danger to a body part. He says, we may say that what is stated regarding eyes could apply to other Eivarim, that they are linked to Eivarim on which life depends. Maybe it's not just true about the eye, maybe other body parts also have connections to life and death issues. And since possible life-saving overrides Shabbos, therefore every danger to an Eiver must be permitted due to doubt. You follow? Since I don't know the ramifications of this particular damage to this particular body part, therefore I need to be careful. Got it? So two different explanations for why Sakanas Eiver is viewed as different from general illness. Either because, as we said first, as Naomi said, it's a permanent loss, or because it could really lead to danger to the body as a whole, and we don't know how. Bailey?
No, it's okay. I got the answer.
Okay, great. Whichever argument we bring to explain why we view it as different, the Shulchan Aruch shows that we view it as different in source number 11. And this is a source that we've read before. We're going to go back into it now in order to see how we're supposed to treat Sakanas Eiver, danger to a body part. The Shulchan Aruch in source number 11 is talking about how you treat a chola she'ein bo sakana, somebody who is ill, but their life is not in danger. And it gives me four different views. View number one and view number 4 are extremes, and then view 2 and view 3 draw distinctions. So view number 1, take a look at source number 11, please. For one who is bedridden from illness, but not endangered. And the Rama adds, or Moshe Esterles adds, one who is in such pain that his whole body is ill, even if he can walk. We're not going into the definition of Chol HaShem Bo Sakana right now. So the first view says, we tell a non-Jew to heal him, but we would not violate biblical laws of Shabbos. Even if a body part were endangered, we would not violate biblical laws of Shabbos. As far as having a Jew violate a rabbinic prohibition, so view number one says, some permit it even without danger to a body part. View number one says, you can violate derabbanans for anyone who is chola she'ein bo sakana, not dangerously ill, even without danger to a body part, sakana saver, it doesn't matter. You could always violate a rabbinic prohibition for such a person. That's view number one. That's the most lenient view out there. Got it? That's view one. I'm jumping to the last line that, of some permit, the fourth view in this, just because I think it's easier to learn it in this order. View number four. Some permit violation of rabbinic laws which are not tied to a biblical prohibition, regardless of danger to a body part. This view number four says, I'm not okay with you violating full derabanans, even if there is danger to a body part. Only a derabanan which isn't linked to a biblical prohibition. We talked about that a while ago, how there are some derabanans that are just protecting violation of a biblical one, preventing violation of a biblical law. And then there are derabanans like telling a non-Jew to do something or mukta that are considered to be their own thing, that are considered separate. So view number four says you can't violate a full derabanan for these cases. Whether there's danger to a body part or not doesn't matter. Yes, Bailey.
So all these views are just talking about sakanat aver, but they're also comparing it to danger of a body part.
Right.
To give
so,
it a little bit more.
Right. So view number one and view number four say sakanas aver is irrelevant. They say all cholesh embo sakana is the same. So the view number one was super lenient, whether there's sakanas aver or not. And view number four is strict, whether there's sakanas aver or not. It doesn't matter. It's views two and three that draw distinctions, which is why I wanted to do one and four first, get them out of the way, and then we see two and three. Everyone else follow that? View one, view four say anybody who's cholesh embo sakana includes anybody who has sakana saver. The rules are the same. It's two and three that
wait,
that,
can you repeat that line you just said?
Yes. Okay. View number one and view number four view sakana saver as within cholesh embo sakana. It's not a separate thing. They're all.
Wait, sorry. What's the last one?
View number one, view number one, and view number four. Treat chola she'en bo sakana, treat sakanas aver as the same as chola she'en bo sakana. There's no distinction. So view number one said you could violate derabanans for anyone who is chola she'en bo sakana, which includes anybody who has sakanas aver. And view number four said you could only violate certain kinds of derabanans for cholesh embo sakana, whether sakana's aver or not, doesn't matter. Was that clear? Okay. So now we get to the middle two cases, the middle two views. So the second view that he brings says some permit violation, meaning of a derabanan, if a body part is endangered, but not otherwise. Only sakanas aver allows violating a derabanan. So general cholesh embo sakana, don't violate a derabanan. Sakanas aver, then you could violate a derabanan. Got it? That's view number two. You can violate a derabanan if there's sakanas aver, but not for cholesh embo sakana in general. And then view number three says some permit direct violation of a derabanan if a body part is endangered, and violation in an altered way if no body part is endangered. So according to this view, also we distinguish between cholesh embo sakana and sakanas aver. Cholesh embo sakana, you can violate a derabanan with a shinui, in an unusual way. Sakanas aver, you could violate a derabanan, no shinui needed. Yes, Ruthie.
These are all for, like, Rav Yosef Karo derabanan, like violating a derabanan, not
derisa. Correct. Entirely derabanans.
Are you able to repeat view number three?
Yeah. So number three, that's the one that's underlined, says, if it's sakanas aver, then you can violate a derabanan straight. If it's just chola she'en bo sakana, you can violate a derabanan with a shinoi, in an altered way. We haven't discussed yet what an altered way is. That's not happening until after Sukkos. Is that clear? Okay, yeah. Bailey, you were going to say?
Could you repeat number two?
The second one is to say that you can't violate a derabanan at all for chol she'en bo sakana. You are able to do it for sakanas eiver. It makes no mention of shinui at all.
But only a derabanan.
Only a derabanan. All of these are only derabanans, as Ruthie had asked. Yeah. Everyone good? Okay. So, in practice, we follow view number three. That's why it's underlined. We say sakanas eiver is worse than chola she'en bo sakana, and it warrants directly violating a derabanan. That's the rule. Whether because, as we said, as Rabbi Ever said, because we don't want people losing something permanently, or because sakanas eiver could lead to pikuach nefesh in ways that we don't even understand. So now we need to ask, so what exactly is sakanas eiver? What exactly is this? What is an eiver? So I already told you when we discussed sakanas eiver in the beginning, not today, but weeks ago, that there is a Mishnah in Ahalos, which lists 248 evarim, parts of the body. The technically 248 in a male, different number in a female. And the Rav Shmuel Wozner, who was a leading halachic authority in Israel, believed that's what counts. That's what is an aver for this purpose. It has to be one of those 248. However, halachic authorities tend to disagree with this in practice and say that it doesn't mean that. It means any functional unit of the body. Whether it's on the list of 248 or not doesn't make a difference. A functional unit of the body. So it can be a pancreas, it can be a finger. Those are evarim. If you take a look at number 12, and then Naomi, I'll come back to you. But if you take a look at source number 12, I mentioned this, but I didn't have it on the source sheet when we first discussed this topic. Rabbi Yeshua Neuwirth, who was the author of Shmira Shabbos Kehilchasa, a major work on Halachos of Shabbos, says, there is room to say that danger to an Aver is not only regarding a human Aver from one of the 248 Avarim. For any distinct component of the human body, regarding which there is concern that if it were not treated now, it would cease to function. This is also called danger to an aver. Any distinct component of the human body is his definition. Yes, Naomi.
For the four things, for number three, we said that we go by number three?
Yeah, correct.
Okay, why do we go by that one?
So the Mishnah Berurah says that's the Shulchan Aruch's preferred view. It's the Mishnah Berurah's read of the Shulchan Aruch to say that that's the preferred view.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So an aver is a distinct functional part of the human body. What counts as danger? So you saw it in number 12, Rabbi Neuwirth's line. He said, if it were not treated now, it would cease to function. That's what we're talking about. There is some discussion about where it can be treated at a later date, but I don't want to go there. I think I'm doing a good job confusing people without that. So let's talk applications for this. Specific examples. One question that comes up a lot is the question of teeth. If a person is going to lose a tooth, an adult tooth, I'm not talking baby tooth now. So a person is going to lose an adult tooth. Does that count as sakanas eiver? So, such that a Jew could now violate a derabanan in order to enable it to stay. What would you say?
Well,
Yes.
I hear a yes. Why?
Because it's a component of the human body.
Mm-hmm.
It's a distinct component of the human body.
Right. And it will no longer function. Right. So if you take a look at source number 13, right, Moshe Tendler, who passed away a few years ago and was a giant in medical halacha, medical ethics. He was actually my professor for biology when I was at YU, which was very good. But take a look at number 13. He and Dr. Fred Rosner, who has done a lot of his own work in medical halacha bioethics, he also has done a lot of translations, they jointly wrote an article called Dental Emergencies on the Sabbath in the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society, which is also a very good journal to know about for those who are interested in medical halacha. They have very interesting articles. So he writes, since the jaw is an aver, he's not looking at the individual tooth as an aver, he says the jaw is an aver, and the absence of teeth interferes with its proper functioning, and since the reimplantation of those teeth would restore the proper functioning of the jaw, the traumatic avulsion of teeth. Anyone know what avulsion is? It's when the tooth comes out. If a tooth comes out, not, you know, naturally, but the tooth got knocked out, that represents a situation of cheston aver. So their position is that counts. Rabbi Evers, who we mentioned before, in source number 14, that same responsum, also takes that view. He challenges the view of the Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. Rabbi Berlin, who lived in Russia at the end of the 19th century, said, come on, tough it out. He says, you can chew without one of your teeth. What's the big deal? Lots of people in 19th century Russia didn't have all their teeth. So if you take a look, we'll see his quote, but this is a response to that in number 14. Regarding Rabbi Berlin, the Netziv, his statement regarding a single tooth, that since one can chew with his other teeth, this is not considered danger to an aver. In my humble opinion, this is shocking, for the collection of teeth is a combination of multiple individual teeth which become a single unit via which a person can chew. We don't look at each tooth independently. Each tooth is part of the collection of teeth. If so, what is the basis for distinguishing between one tooth and all of his teeth? Certainly loss of one or two teeth would limit chewing, and no tooth was created for nothing. He says all of the teeth have a role to play. Some of them chew one way, some of them chew another way, but he says you need all of your teeth, and therefore it counts as sakanas aver. But others disagree. Rav Wozner, who I mentioned earlier, who said that you have to look at the list of the 248, right, from the Mishnah, he says teeth aren't on the list. Teeth are not on that list, therefore they don't count. The Netziv says they also don't, Rav Wozner also notes source number 15, which is a Mishnah in that Masechta of Ahalos, which says any part of a corpse communicates impurity, other than teeth, hair, and nails, when they're not connected to the body. Meaning a tooth that's been knocked out is not considered part of the body. It's not considered a body part. Ditto, hair that's been cut, nails that have been cut off. So he says, a tooth is not called a body part. That has relevance for a Gemara that we're not going to talk about right now. But take a look at source number 16, where you see the argument from Rabbi Berlin, the Netziv. He says, we've learned one who has a toothache should not rinse with vinegar. That's a whole discussion about rinsing with vinegar. Does it look like medical treatment? Does it look like something that you would normally eat? So he says, one of the students asked, perhaps this, the toothache, involves danger to an aver. And it appears appropriate to deduce from here that danger to an aver is only where one cannot make up for the deficiency. For even seeing with one eye is not like seeing with two eyes. But where one is missing a tooth, he can still chew with the other teeth. So therefore, he argues, it's not sakanas aver. Another one on this side is Rav Herschel Schechter, who I put the question to. And his answer was, false teeth work very well. People can get something inserted and then they're fine. So their jaw retains its function. You didn't get back your original tooth, but your jaw is still functioning. So this is subject to a debate. That's the way that I'm leaving it, is that this is subject to a debate. But it does have practical relevance because of what one might need to do in order to preserve a tooth if it gets knocked out on Shabbos and you want to have it implanted. You know, to implant it fully may involve biblical prohibitions, but to be able to save it and, you know, potentially reinsert it may involve some kind of a derabanan. So this, you know, this is something to be very aware of. One other note is a question of fertility treatments. What if a woman is in a position where she's not able to have children, the uterus, the ovaries are not, you know, fully working right now. However, she could have a treatment that would enable her to be able to have children. So the is she allowed to do that on Shabbos, assuming it's only a derabanan? So I brought you source number 17, Rabbi Avigdor Nevensal. So Rav Nevensal, who's a great Rav in Yerushalayim, wrote an article on this, a response, a matshuva on this, in Shut Pua. Has anyone here heard of Machon Pua? Is that at all familiar? Okay. So Machon Pua is another entity you should be aware of. I keep mentioning different books to know about. Machon Pua is an organization in Israel that studies halacha and fertility. And they've done a lot of work on some of the major issues that come up in fertility today, IVF obviously being one of them, but there's a lot more than just IVF. And they also have books that they've issued with articles on major medical halacha in this area. So Rav Nevensal says that certain treatments would be justified for the sake of enabling a woman to become pregnant. But he says, specifically, treatments that make the parts of the body function well, not treatments that replace the functioning of those organs. Do you catch the distinction? The way to deal with sakanas aver that's justified on Shabbos is if you repair the aver so that it will function, not replacing the function. So he writes in number 17, there are some treatments which do not repair avarim, but only substitute for them, such as inserting seed or an egg in IVF, which do not involve repairing avarim. In other words, if you told me the woman's uterus isn't functioning properly, however, by adding this hormone, I'm making that up, now the uterus will function. So I would call that repairing the uterus. You've now corrected for the loss of the function of this body part. However, if the problem is that the delivery mechanism for conception is not operating properly, and so you're going to, you know, avoid that by inserting the seed directly or fertilizing the egg directly, you're not making the body part function properly. You're just simulating it effectively. So that you wouldn't be able to violate a derabanan for. Was that somewhat clear? That distinction? Okay. So, summarizing what we've said about sakanas aver, we said that if it could lead to danger to life, if we know it could lead to danger to life, then it's safek pikuach nefesh. That's what we were talking about earlier. But if not, we still treat it as more severe than general chola she'en bo sakana. We brought the different views in the Shulchan Aruch about how we treat it. The ruling accepted in the Shulchan Aruch is that we would violate a derabanan for sakanas eiver. No shinoi needed, right? Shinoi is only needed for chola she'en bo sakana. The reason for treating it differently was either because losing a body part is worse than chola she'en bo sakana, or because it might actually lead to danger to the body as a whole. Maybe we don't know how, but it could. We said aver is either, the view of Rav Wozner is that it's one of the 248 body parts in the Mishnah and Ahalos, or a functional unit of the body. distinct functional unit of the body, and that was what I brought you from Rav Neuwirth. If it won't function as it normally does, that's sakanas aver. And we talked about two potential applications. We have the debate regarding teeth. On the one hand, the jaw can function. You can still chew. On the other hand, you can't chew as well. Each tooth has a purpose. And the possibility for fertility treatments where they make a part of the body work as opposed to where they replace that part of the body. Clear? Good? Okay. So I don't want to do this as a poll because that's not really so nice.